So when you think about what it might mean to be a successor to somebody, what comes to mind for you in that? And that's an actual question.
Inherit.
Okay.
No, not inherit, but
inheriting. Inheriting, yeah. Okay.
Legacy.
Legacy, very good. Cool, so Morgan. Okay, yeah. So kind of anxiety and pressure a little bit. Right. So, you know, I had a couple of things that came to mind. So there's a little bit of anxiety sometimes for some people, right? Responsibility, determination. Legacy is good because legacy is actually what we're going to talk about tonight. You know, with this, when it comes to being a successor comes to mind, I often think about, you know, is this what you really want? You know, when you're going into a position and you're offered, it's like, I want you to be the guy. I want you to be the one who comes after me. That's, you know, some people, yes, I really want to do that. And some people are like, that sounds cool, but it also sounds really scary because you were really good at this. And like Warren said, now I feel like I have to, like, step it up and just kind of jump two levels so that I can be as good as you might have been. The person that we're going to talk about tonight in association with that will be Elisha the prophet. So Elisha succeeded Elijah, and he had a pretty big measure to live up to, big sandals to fill, because he was actually specifically called to be Elijah's successor, which is a little different than some other instances for prophets. They receive a call, they do their stuff, and actually we'll talk a little bit more about how becoming a prophet, what that was. It was kind of different than some of what we often think of, especially when you read about a guy like Elijah who just kind of pops up here and there. God has this for me to give to you, and we're going to do this really amazing thing, and then sort of fades out and smoke bomb, and he's gone, right? Kind of like Jesus with his ninja powers. Elijah had that to some extent, too. So, multitude of prophets in those days, but Elijah was probably considered the prophet at that time. He would have been kind of the head, the big guy. Timelines get a little hectic, especially when you read Kings and Chronicles, because not everything feels like it goes in an actual chronological order when they're arranged in the stories. There are certain parts that where you're just like, well, wait, you just mentioned this guy here, and two chapters ago he got leprosy, and now he seems like he's fine. So how did this happen? It's almost like watching a Tarantino movie. All right. While Elijah was active in ministry, he was considered the lead guy. Elisha spent the better part of 8 years under his tutelage learning the ways of a prophet, but we really don't get too much insight into what that meant, into what that entailed. The first bit we're going to read is in 1 Kings in chapter 19. Just the last little bit. So context for this part up to this. We've kind of talked about this before in another message. Previous to this part happening, Elijah had just had his really great showdown with the prophets of Baal. He had kind of showed them up really badly and then had all 450 of them killed after they failed to live up to said expectation and they realized that Baal is nothing and God is there. But directly after that, Elijah is threatened by Queen Jezebel, as she says that, far be it from me if by the end of the day tomorrow you are not in the same position as all of those people that you just killed, you know. And so he gets scared and he runs away, runs into the desert, has an encounter with the Holy Spirit with an angel, gets nourishment, and then wanders 40 more days and 40 nights further into the wilderness to Mount Horeb, which is where Moses had one of his encounters directly with God. Elijah has an encounter with God directly, and God asks him, hey, what are you doing? And he's like, he gives some excuses, and he kind of whines a little bit because he's kind of feeling like I'm doing this all by myself. I don't have anybody to help me, and, you know, this is hard. And, you know, God reassures him that, hey, I've got 7,000 that have not, you know, kneeled to Baal. I have plenty of people who are still loyal to me. You're okay. But he gives him three specific things at that point, and we're going to read those beginning in chapter 19, verse 15. So then the Lord said to him, him as Elijah. Return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria. Also, you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah. Okay. You shall anoint as prophet in your place. It shall be thus that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill, and whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So pretty cool for Elijah. At that point, he maybe has get a little bit of a feeling of, okay, maybe things aren't so bad. So he departs from there, and he found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he was with the 12th. Then Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Please let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you." And he said to him, "Go back again, for what have I done to you?" So Elisha turned back from him and took a yoke of oxen, slaughtered them and boiled their flesh using the oxen's equipment, and gave it to the people. And they ate, and then he arose and followed Elijah and became his servant. That's our introduction to Elisha, and then that's kind of all we hear about him for the next couple of chapters, which is about 8 years worth of time. So yeah, on the heels of one of the highest and most zealous moments of his prophetic career, Elijah's afraid. He wanders off into the wilderness, has an experience with God. God tells him to do three specific things. So you're going to go and you're going to anoint this guy the king of Syria, you're going to anoint this guy the king of Israel, and you're going to anoint this guy as your successor. He kind of does them in reverse order. And actually, as we'll see, he really only does one of those things, which is kind of odd to me. But he goes and finds Elisha first. Why? Because he probably felt kind of like he needed somebody to be there with him maybe a little bit. So he goes and he finds Elijah and he puts the mantle of the prophet, so the mantle that he wears, he puts that on his shoulders, which is a very symbolic gesture of saying, you have been chosen to be the next guy. It's up to Elisha to accept that and say, yes, I will do this. And it's a pretty big honor. It's also a really big responsibility because not only has a prophet of the Lord come and said, I want you to also be a prophet, and you're not only going to be that, but you're going to be the guy who I am directly responsible for bringing up into this, and then you're going to follow after me. That feels like a lot of pressure. So Elijah makes a pretty quick decision, right? He says, hey, I just need to say goodbye to my folks and my friends, and then I will follow after you. And Elijah says, hey, I didn't do this to you. It's like, God chose you. I came here because God told me to choose you, which is kind of that, well, what did I do to you kind of response. Elisha could have just said, hey, I don't want to do this, so have a nice day. Probably wouldn't have worked out so well for him if he had gone that route, but he definitely had an option to do that. But he doesn't. He says goodbye to his folks. He throws a feast for his friends because he also knows that in accepting this call to follow Elijah, he is never going to come back and be with this same group of people and with his family in the same capacity. He might see them again, but he's not going to be living there, and he's not going to be experiencing a daily life with them any longer. So he is pretty much leaving for good. And like I said, we actually don't hear much about his prophetic tutelage he receives. And he doesn't actually even come up again in Scripture until Elijah is called home. Until Elijah goes up to be in heaven, which is where we're going to jump to next in 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 1. But actually, in between there, as I was reading this morning and going through this, there's a really interesting story in 2 Kings chapter 1, which I would recommend that you guys read because it was really interesting to look at Elijah sitting on a hill and the current king of Israel's falling through latticework and being basically handicapped or injured, and he's like, hey, go send somebody to the prophet of Baal in wherever to see if I'm going to be okay and I'm going to live. And Elijah turns the servant around and says, nope, you don't get to go there. And so he goes back and tells the king, well, he told us not to go because he said there's a prophet of God in Israel. And so he sends more servants. He basically sends a captain of a guard of 50. So he sends 50 troops plus a captain to collect Elijah and tell him, you will come to see me. And so the first guy goes up there and says, hey, the king says you need to come down and come with us. And he's like, hey, if I'm a man of God, if the king has required you to come down and be here. And Elijah says, if I'm a man of God, then may you and your whole company of 50 be burned up by fire in the sky. All 50 people in the captain are just incinerated. And this happens twice. So 100 people, 102 people, if you count the captains, get eliminated because of their audacity and arrogance to just command Elijah to do something. The third guy finally gets a clue and it's like, please don't, please have mercy and please would you come see the king. And he goes, and unfortunately that king doesn't live very long after that. Yeah. So it's just like, not going to come with you like that. So it's great. It's a really interesting story, and I highly recommend giving it a read. It happens all in 2 Kings chapter 1. Yeah. All right, so 2 Kings chapter 2 is where we're going to pick up and talk about Elijah, because this is where Elijah has known that he's about to have his final day on earth. And it came to pass when the Lord was about to take Elijah up into heaven by a whirlwind that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. And then Elijah said to Elisha, stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to Bethel. But Elisha said, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So they went down to Bethel. Now the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, do you know that the Lord will take away your master from you, from over you today? And he said, yes, I know. Keep silent. Then Elijah said to him, Elisha, stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to Jericho. But he said, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So they came to Jericho. Now the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho came to Elisha and said, do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today? And so he answered, yes, I know. Keep silent. Then Elijah said to him, stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to the Jordan. But he said, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So the two of them went on, and 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood facing them at a distance while the two of them stood by the Jordan. Okay. Elijah knows it's his time, and honestly, it looks like apparently Elisha and the sons of the prophets all kind of have an understanding that Elijah has, you know, basically come to a point where this is the end for him. I don't know that they had a full understanding of exactly what was going to happen. I think Elijah had a pretty good understanding of what was going to happen, but Elisha and the sons of the prophets probably just had, well, he's going to be taken away, he's going to die in the desert, it's his final day, whatever. I found the terminology for the sons of the prophets as being interesting because these guys are actually students or pupils being trained in the office of prophecy. And so there were centers in Israel that where they actually had people who trained students in prophecy and what it meant to be in the office of a prophet, which is a little different than what we usually think of for somebody called to a prophet. They hear God from on high, and they get a message, and they go, and they give it like they're supposed to. But there's a little more, I guess, to that in from a traditional Jewish perspective and something. So these guys had centers of learning for people, and it might not have just been prophecy. It might have also been all of the extended learning that they did in Torah and all of the learning that they did as part of their studies. But it refers to them, the sons of the prophets refers to these people who are being trained for that office. So three times Elijah tests the devotion of Elisha by asking him to remain behind. He's like, look, God's called me onto here. I'm going to go. You stay here. And every time Elisha says the same thing, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. He's committed. He's prepared to follow his teacher and friend to the very end of the road. He's like, no, this is it. Wherever you're going, I'm going. I'm going to be there with you. And I found it interesting that the other people kept saying, hey, you know today's the day, right? Yeah, I know that. Please stop talking. You know? So we're going to go on. 2 Kings chapter 2, starting at verse 8. Like, now Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water. And it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. And so it was, when they had crossed over, that Elijah said to Elisha, ask, what may I do for you before I am taken away from you? And Elisha said, please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. So he said, you have asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so. Then it happened, as they continued on and talked, that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried out, "My father, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen." So he saw him no more, and he took hold of his own clothes and tore them into two pieces. And then he took up the mantle of Elijah that he had fallen from him and went back and stood by the bank of the Jordan. And then he took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water and said, "Where is the Lord God of Elijah?" And when he had also struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. So Elijah pretty much does a really weird, interesting thing. He basically takes his mantle, his kind of cloak, the thing that he's wearing, he rolls it up, and he kind of goes, and he hits the water, and the water parts, like the Red Sea, like the Jordan parting for Joshua when they parted across. So he joins some rather interesting company of people who crossed on dry ground on a river that was currently flowing. They both cross over. Elijah is satisfied with his testing of Elisha, you know, and the fact that he is committed and he's doing this. So he's like, "What can I do for you? I'm about to go. Things are about to kick off and I'm going to be going. You know, what can I do for you?" And Elisha could have asked for any number of things, and there are a lot of selfish things that he could have asked for, but he didn't ask for power necessarily. He didn't ask for worldly power. He didn't ask for money. He didn't ask for position or, you know, a place of authority, of worldly authority over other people. He's basically said, "I want a double portion of your spirit." And it's the spirit that Elijah operates in, which means it's the spirit of God resting on Elijah. And he's like, "I want the double portion of that." It's a hard thing that he asked for, but it's important to distinguish that he's not asking for twice as much. Even though double seems to indicate that, he's not asking for twice as much of the Spirit, because the Spirit is the Spirit. You've got it or you don't at that point. So what he's asking for is the portion that would typically go to a firstborn son in Jewish culture. When the father passes away, the firstborn male gets a double portion of the inheritance, and then the rest is split evenly between the rest or by whatever other measure that they're using. So he's not asking for twice as much, but he's asking for the portion that would go to the firstborn son. He's asking to be considered to be Elijah's successor, to be his spiritual son and the person who is taking over the office and the prophetic ministry that he has operated in up to that point. Which he's already basically been given. God has already appointed that to him, as we read in 1 Kings chapter 19. But he's asking for the power to fulfill that calling for him. Elijah tells him that, you know what, okay, that's a hard thing. But here's how it lays out. If you see me when I'm taken away, if you see that happen and you witness it, then your request has been granted. If you don't see it, then that's just not how it's supposed to be. And they move on. They keep talking about whatever prophets of the day talked about while they were traveling back and forth on the roads there. All of a sudden, something that was probably awe-inspiring and mildly terrifying, because there is now a chariot and horses that are on fire that are roaming through and moving right through everybody, and they separate Elijah and Elisha, and the whirlwind that follows the chariot actually picks up Elijah and carries him off into heaven, and Elijah sees him no more. That had to be really interesting to experience. I'm trying to imagine what my reaction would be to seeing, you know, horses and chariots made out of fire just sort of flying past, knocking you on your butt while the other guy gets carried away by the cyclone out into no more. All right, you know, Elisha, you know, even though he had some kind of understanding about, hey, something is going to happen to Elijah today. I don't exactly know what it is, but I know he's not going to be coming back with me from this walk out into the wilderness. So to speak. Even though he understands that, it's still surprising, and he's still upset. You know, he's still mourning. He tears his clothes into two pieces, which is a sign of deep mourning in the culture. And he says, you know, my father, the chariot of Israel and horsemen. And that's a really interesting statement. Because it actually, hold on. It reveals his understanding of the truth, the fact that the true strength of Israel lies in the man of God being among the people and working and providing God's voice to the people around him. And now he is gone. And actually, interestingly enough, as you read the rest of 2 Kings, in chapter 13, when Elisha passes away, King Joash says the same statement when mourning Elisha's passing for him. So there's the mantle on the ground, left behind. Didn't get carried away with Elijah, so the mantle of the prophet is there. He goes over. It didn't, you know, and it's interesting because it didn't just flutter back down out of the heavens and come to rest on Elisha's shoulder with sunbeams and angelic chorus and, you're the guy. He has to physically go over and pick up the mantle and choose to put it on. He has to physically go, I am accepting, I asked for it, and now I am accepting it. And I am going to be the guy, I am going to do this. That's a pretty big decision. Because again, he could have at any point there going, you know what, I changed my mind, I don't want to do this, and just sort of take off running and head back home and pretend like none of this ever happened. But he doesn't do that. He chooses to accept the responsibility of being the prophet, and he begins to build his own legacy. He's willing to accept the responsibility of the legacy of Elijah, which is a big deal. And he's been the guy who's been on the scene at this point. So he is building at that point, choosing to go, I am going to honor this, and I am going to choose to step into it and walk in it and start to build my own way. He walks back to the Jordan. He performs the same action of touching the mantle to the waters. They part. He crosses back to the other side. His question is a very powerful one. Where is the Lord God of Elijah? He's not doubting, but he's recognizing that God's still ever present in the power. The power isn't in the mantle or the fiery chariots, but it's the spirit of Jehovah working through him. It was also a demonstration to the men who are on the other side of the Jordan waiting for him to come back, for them to see that, hey, yes, now that spirit, the same spirit that Elijah carried, I now carry. And that by, you know, definition of how this occurred. And so you can see in chapter 2, verse 15, now when the sons of the prophets who were from Jericho saw him, they said, the spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha. They came to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. Then they said to him, look now, there are 50 strong men with your servants. Please let them go and search for your master, lest perhaps the spirit of the Lord has taken him up and cast him upon some mountain or into some valley. And he said, you shall not send anyone. That Jedi trick doesn't work, though, because they keep pestering. But when they had urged him till he was ashamed, he said, send them. Therefore, they sent 50 men. They searched for 3 days, but did not find him. And when they came back to him, for he stayed in Jericho, he said to them, did I not say to you, do not go? So they witness Elijah cross over. They accept that he's his successor, but they're still like, they still didn't have a full understanding of, well, yeah, we saw the cyclone, but that doesn't mean Elijah didn't land somewhere else when the cyclone was done. You know, you ever seen somebody picked up by a tornado and tossed, you know, in some footage? You might land miles away. So they're figuring, yeah, this was a horrible thing, and we would like to go collect his body and give him a proper, you know, send-off, give him a proper burial. And Elisha's like, no, you don't need to do that. And they keep pestering him to the point where he feels like, oh, am I actually not doing something right by not letting them go? He finally just relents and says, just go, just do it. Even though in his head, he's saying, hey, this is a waste of time. You don't need to do that. And they come back three days later and say, we couldn't find him. And he's like, I told you not to go. I told you not to do this. And so with that, he's in Jericho, and he performs his first set of actual public miracle. The men of the city, back in verse 19, then the men of the city said to Elisha, please notice the situation of the city is pleasant, as my lord sees, but the water is bad and the ground is barren. And he said, bring me a new bowl and put salt in it. So they brought it to him, and then he went out to the source of the water and cast in the salt there and said, thus says the Lord, I have healed this water. From it there shall be no more death or barrenness. So the water remains healed to this day, according to the word that Elisha spoke. Then he went up from there to Bethel, and as he was going up the road, some youths came out from the city and mocked him and said to him, go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head. So he turned around and looked at them and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Lord. And two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. And then he went from there to Mount Carmel, and from there he returned to Samaria. So that's a thing. These are two pretty striking events right at the beginning of Elisha's ministry. First, the people of Jericho, you know, say, hey, the water here is kind of crappy. Can you help us out with that? So, you know, their water was nearly unusable. So Elisha asked for something simple. He's like, give me a bowl and some salt. And he takes the salt. He speaks the words as the Lord directs him. Pours the salt in the water. The water is healed, and it stayed that way. The water was purified, and it was able to be used for drinking. It was able to be used for irrigation. And from there, Elisha travels up to Bethel, and on his way into town, he's met by a group of youths who are taunting him. It's important to understand that youths, translated from the Hebrew, is a pretty broad term. It's used to refer to, just in some other areas, just to give you an idea of ages, it's used to refer to Joseph in Egypt in Genesis when he was about 39. He was a youth at 39. It's translated, it's for Absalom when he was already a grown man earlier in Kings, and also for Solomon at the age of 20. So youth is a broad term for a younger man or younger person. This is not a group of children who were playing outside and decided to tease a guy they saw who might have been missing some hair. This is a group of people who are not only, it's a large group of young men who are insulting Elijah, they're insulting his office as a prophet, and they're also insulting the people he's come from, and Elijah and the Lord. It's worth noting that while we mentioned a school of prophetic ministry or people being trained for prophetic offices in Bethel, Bethel at that time was also one of the pagan worship centers in Israel. It was set up by King Jeroboam to prevent the tribes of Israel from being tempted to reunite with Judah by going to Jerusalem to worship. Because while the kingdom was united, you went to Jerusalem to the temple to worship. That was how you performed your sacrifices. That was where you went to do your stuff. And when the kingdom split, Jeroboam was like, I don't want our people having to go to Jerusalem because they're not part of us anymore, and I don't want them to be tempted to, you know, defect. So, and also, I'm not really following God all that closely, and so we're going to set up two golden calves. We're going to set up one in Dan, and we're going to set up one in Bethel. And we're going to tell the people, this is where you go to worship. Here is your representation of your God. They didn't learn from the golden calf thing from back in Genesis, or Exodus, rather. So these people are already kind of hostile to the idea of an actual prophet of the Lord. Elisha's response may have been a bit angry. You know, he basically curses them in the name of the Lord. But he never actually incites violence against them deliberately. He's not saying, I want you to, you know, I'm going to do this to you. He's like, in the name of the Lord, may you be cursed. And it doesn't specifically even say what he said. Bears, probably. He left it in the hands of the Lord. And the Lord didn't waste any time because two bears come out and tear 42 people into a couple of them were. They weren't all killed, so the word mauled translated doesn't actually just mean dead, it just means they were injured by the bears. And the group of people was larger than 42. Because when the bears come crashing out of the wilderness and attack them, what are you going to do if all of a sudden two bears are charging at you? You're going to run the other direction, hopefully. And all you need to do is run faster than the guy next to you, because as long as you can get away faster than them, they're going to get eaten first, right? It's a horrible thing. At any rate, you know, the bears served as a means to protect Elisha, sure, but it also demonstrated the power of the Lord, and it provided a warning to the city that, hey, don't do this. And so this is Elisha's introduction to being the office of prophet and being in this. I would love to know more about what he actually experienced in the 8 years prior when he was serving with Elijah and what that looked like and how that functioned, but we really don't get any of that in the text. But I do know that Elisha continued to serve as a prophet for another 60 years after this. There's a multitude of other stories. As you read through 2 Kings, there's some really unique things that Elisha does that are also very much in tandem. When you look at the initial prophetic introduction for Elijah. It also has to do with water. It has to do with rain being shut up in the sky. He basically says, hey, God said that it's not going to rain until I tell it to rain. And it didn't for 3.5 years. Of course, Elisha's was a little bit less dramatic than that, but nevertheless, it was still a miracle with water. He also had a similar story where he made a jar of oil to be everlasting for the most part. A woman was able to fill jars upon jars upon jars of oil that she could sell to pay off her debts because she was the widow of the prophet Obadiah, who Elisha would have been familiar with because he was a contemporary of Elijah. He also brought a child back to life in a similar manner to what Elijah did. And in one text that I read earlier today, that child that he brought back to life supposedly was the prophet Habakkuk. I could only find one text that went that, so I don't know if that's actually true or if that's just somebody's idea. But yeah. But it's an interesting idea nonetheless. He heals Naaman from Syria of leprosy, and that's a fun story because that's a longer story. We're not going to go into that, but I know Alberto's talked about that one in the past. And when he dies, they bury him, and so a short time after, somebody else is put in the same tomb as Elisha and is brought back to life just by being in Elisha's presence in the tomb. So he had a lasting legacy of his own. And so I look at that, and I say, hey, how does that affect or translate to our lives? I also found it interesting before I go into that piece, that remember in 1 Kings 19, Elijah was given 3 things to do. He's like, go find Elisha. He's going to be your successor. Go anoint this guy as king of Syria, which is Hazael, and go anoint Jehu as the king of was Israel because there were 2. Elijah doesn't actually end up doing either one of those things. All he does is he finds Elisha, and he anoints him as his successor. Elisha is the one that actually goes and anoints Hazael as king of Syria, which is really weird to me that the prophet of Israel is anointing somebody in Syria as king. But he also, in doing so, it was revealed by the Lord that Syria was going to cause great pain to Israel, and that was very hard for Elisha to hear. As you read the text, he actually tells the story to Hazael, like, you are going to cause great distress for my country, and it pains me. It makes me sob and weep. And you know, very directly thereafter, Hazael kills the current king and becomes king of Syria and begins to trouble Israel. And then he brings in Jehu. So I thought that was really interesting. Not only did he honor the legacy of Elijah, but he also finishes things that Elijah was tasked to do. He also makes sure that legacy is complete. And he builds a legacy of his own because, as you can see going through 2 Kings and reading those stories, he did become that prophet, the guy who was the one at that point. How does that affect us and translate to our lives? I think that the idea of legacy in our lives is something that we don't always think about. Some people, well, I shouldn't say we don't always. I don't always think about it. Some people think about it a lot. Some people might spend too much time thinking about it, and then they don't really do anything currently to advance that situation. But I think our focus as people, legacy is important because we want to leave something for the people who come after us. We want to be remembered. It's kind of a desire in human beings also all the way around. We want to feel like what we did while we were here meant something and mattered. We definitely want it to mean something and matter to us while we're here, but there's also a part of us that really wants it to mean something and matter to the people who are still here when we're gone. From our perspective as a collective body, as a church, as people who are meeting together, we want our legacy as a group. We want to honor the people who have come before us. We want to honor the church fathers and the people that we've grown up with and those things, and honor the good things that they did, and make sure that we continue in those things. We want to also recognize things that didn't quite go as well as they could have and make steps to correct that while we're building our own legacy as something that is to be remembered. As our personal group, yeah, we've had issues and we've had things that we've had to go through. We're learning from those things so that when we're building the legacy that we want to leave behind for the people that come after us is that those things are not what people remember as this is a thing that they couldn't overcome. This is the thing that happened. They learned from it. They built on top of it, and they built something better. And so coming out of that and coming out of legacy, when we're learning how to build community, when we're learning what that actually means for us in our direct group of people and community, but more importantly, how as a group we are interacting with our greater community and what we are planning to do or wanting to do to make sure that we have a voice and we have an impact in that realm, that's part of the legacy that we want. It's not just about the people who come here once a week and have a good time and meet them. Yeah, this is cool, and this is necessary because this helps us recharge and helps us get to a point, but what we do out there in the name of Jesus is what really matters. That was the point, you know, is that, you know, it wasn't about, okay, everybody get together and have your rah-rah session and then come back in a week when it's all cool. Yes, come here and have your rah-rah session, come here and have your encouragement and help, you know, especially because some weeks are tough. And it's nice to come here and see the people that we love and that we appreciate and can get some encouragement so that when we go and start the next week, we have gas in the tank so that we can move forward. But it's not just about that, because it's what we do once we're outside there, and what we're attempting to do is what really matters. And so I want to take and look at what these prophets have done and see what does that mean for us. Yes, sometimes you can look at a guy like Obadiah and read the one chapter that you have in here that's a very specific prophecy about Edom, and what does that mean in reference to what was happening at the time. But we can still take some of that stuff and say, okay, well, prophecy was about warnings, but it was also about encouragement and exhortation as well. So what can we do there? So one of the things that I will be doing personally is I will be kind of doing a series on some of the different prophets, and I'm going to put it on the website at least once a month. I'm trying for twice, but we'll see. But this was kind of part of the first one for that. But my encouragement is yes, your legacy is important, and it's important for you to build something personally, and you play an important part for our legacy as City of Refuge and how we interact with the people around us. So my encouragement tonight is, hey, let's get some gas in the tank and let's go do something for our people who are here, who are hurting, who need us, who need Jesus. They don't always necessarily need us, but everybody out there needs Jesus just like we do every day. So let's go and be that. All right. And that's what I got for tonight. So we'll pray us out. Thank you. We'll pray us out, and then we're going to the cottage.